You're listening to After Images, a podcast for cinephiles that takes a deep dive into moving images. Each episode features a special guest who is invited to explore a film of their choice. After Images is hosted by film writers Franck Bouleg and Marisa C. Hayes. On today's episode, we are joined by filmmaker Jack Scholder to discuss Alfred Hitchcock's 1943 feature, Shadow of a Doubt. Hitchcock had already directed five titles in the United States, but it's arguably with this picture that he first managed to create a chilling portrait of a quintessentially American town. Featuring Teresa Wright and Joseph Cotten in the lead roles, most of the story unfolds in the Californian locale of Santa Rosa, a small town that appears completely oblivious to the devastating war simultaneously taking place in Europe and Asia. Young Charlie Newton is bored with her life in this idyllic Eden and welcomes the arrival of her Uncle Charlie as a breath of fresh air. It soon becomes clear, however, that Uncle Charlie is the Merry Widow murderer, the target of a nationwide manhunt. A complex and dangerous game of cat and mouse ensues between the two Charlies, while the rest of the family remains ignorant. Shadow of a Doubt is a memorable entry in Hitchcock's filmography, simultaneously cozy and horrific, playing masterfully with the notion of doubles and keeping the audience guessing until its final frame.
Jack Scholder is an American filmmaker, best known for his work in the horror film genre, notably Alone in the Dark, A Nightmare on Elm Street 2, Freddy's Revenge, The Hidden, and Wishmaster 2, Evil Never Dies.
So, Jack Scholder, welcome to After Images podcast. We're delighted to welcome you today for a discussion of Alfred Hitchcock's 1943 feature, Shadow of a Doubt.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and I'm delighted to talk about that movie or anything about Hitchcock for that matter.
So we usually like to begin with a straightforward question, but that can often be complex in terms of how it's related to one's experience of film and memory. And we wanted to ask, why did you suggest Shadow of a Doubt, and what does it mean to you? What has it meant to you?
Well, you know, everybody's seen Hitchcock films, you know, and I certainly have and had before I thought about ever becoming a filmmaker. But when I was at university, there were very few film programs. You know, film studies was not something unless you went to USC or NYU, one of, you know, the few places that actually taught film. Film was not considered an academic subject. And I had wanted to be a writer. So I was an English major with a minor in philosophy. So I read a lot. So I spent a year at the University of Edinburgh. I spent a summer in France, spending some time in Paris, you know, since my head was filled with, you know, Paris in the 20s, which was the center of the cultural universe then. And toward the end of my stay, I started to get interested in film. I had a girlfriend who really liked film. And I thought, I rather than be a writer, I'll be a film director, you know, naively thinking that, you know, you could just, well, I'll be an accountant or I'll be an engineer. So yeah, I'll be a film director. So, there was no film program where I was. So I just started making films. And then when I graduated, I moved to New York and I got some work as a film editor. And so I sort of became a film editor, but I was also making short films. And one of the ways that I learned about filmmaking was actually this book here, which I'm sure you... Sure, you know, Hitchcock Truffaut, and it's got, you know, things that are underlined in it, and so Before I wanted to be a writer, I wanted to be a musician, and I studied very, very seriously. I wanted to be a classical trumpet player, playing a symphony orchestra. But I took a course in harmony, and the textbook was a book of Bach chorales. It was a book which just had the chorales, and we would go through and we would analyze the harmony and whatever. And so basically, whatever Bach did, those were the rules. And that's the way I feel about Hitchcock. I mean, Hitchcock basically, his DNA is in every thriller that's been made. And when you hear him talk about it, especially with Truffaut, there are enormous number of insights about how to tell a story. And so, he talks about the difference between suspense and surprise, which I'm sure you know about. For people who are listening who may not know, suspense, where he says two people are having lunch, a bomb explodes under the table. Suspense, someone puts a bomb under the table, two people sit down and have lunch. So, and in general, suspense is better because, it lasts longer. This doesn't just apply to thrillers, it applies to everything. A romantic comedy, is the girl gonna kiss the guy? It's always, where you are. Are you ahead of the story, which is suspense? I know that there's a bomb under the table. What's going to happen now? Or are you with the story at the same moment? And there's tons and tons and tons of lessons about, I mean, not just, well, filmmaking, or, well, storytelling in general, but also filmmaking specifically. I mean, one of the great things about Hitchcock was that he used cinema, he used the tools of cinema to tell the story. I mean, there are large chunks of his films where there's no dialogue. North by Northwest, there's the whole scene with the crop duster. There's like 10 minutes without one word of dialogue, and just the way that he tells the story. And so Shadow of a Doubt, I saw, and by the way, I've seen all of his movies. It's possible I haven't seen a few of the very, very, very early silent ones, but starting with The Lodger, I've seen every single one. And I kind of made a point of seeing them all. And I think that Shadow of a Doubt is one of his greatest. I mean, one of the reasons why it's such a great movie is it was written by Thornton Wilder, who is a great playwright, and he had written a play called Our Town, which was sort of this classic story of small town America and everything that America stood for or was supposed to stand for back then, all of which is going to shit right now, of course. Don't get me started with that. There's a lot of moral ambiguity, but it also deals with something that Hitchcock dealt with a lot, which is doubles. I mean, I don't know whether you've gotten into that, but in this movie particularly, and the way that he sets things up, I mean the whole opening, that he just does stuff cinematically that tells you what's going on. And that's the mark of He said that bad directors show people talking, good directors show people thinking.
Love
And
that.
how do you show somebody thinking? You know, if it's a novel, you can say, and he was thinking of Paris. But how do you show that, if you write in the script, he was thinking of Paris. So now how do you show that in a movie? You know, you cut to like a little bubble with the Eiffel Tower in it, or I mean, how do you show what someone is thinking? And Hitchcock was very good at that, and now that's just part of cinematic language.
Do you remember when it was the first time that you saw the film?
I probably in my 20s. It wasn't one of the early ones that I saw. My film school was, reading the Truffaut Hitchcock book, but also, I was living in New York City in the late 60s and the 70s, and there were, a half a dozen or more theaters that showed old movies or foreign movies, and basically that was my education. Whatever was playing, I would go to see. There were a lot of movies. Like now, you can see any movie that you want, but you have to pick the movie. But then it was like, well, this Shadow of a Doubt is now playing on a double feature at this movie theater, so I'm going to go see it. There's Ashes and Diamonds is playing. So now you get to see a film by Andrzej Wajda, who's one of the great directors that I might have never seen. I mean, there was a woman at this university where I taught who taught film studies. She'd never seen never seen Ashes and Diamonds. I was stunned, but I saw a lot of these films just because that was what was playing. I enjoyed it. I mean, there are other movies that are more fun. I actually taught a course. It was part of a summer university program in Madrid, where they had American students who were studying abroad, and so I taught a 3 week class on Hitchcock. And basically, Hitchcock, the British Hitchcock versus the American Hitchcock, because they wanted something that was sort of transcontinental. So, I looked at the films that he did in England versus the films that he did in the United States. And actually, Shadow of a Doubt is one of the earlier films that he did. He did it in 1943, actually in the middle of World War II, which is particularly interesting because we're in the middle of a war, and everybody was making war films, and here's a film that has a very ambiguous view of America. And the students who were in this class, none of them were film students. I mean, none of them were even like literature students. They were like criminal justice or engineering or business, or none of them really had any kind of a connection to anything literary. So it was really interesting to see how they reacted. So, for instance, Strangers on a Train, which is another movie that deals with doubles, they loved it. Shadow of a Doubt is a more is a more is a more difficult. It's North by Northwest. It's like eating a bag of candy. It's so entertaining. It's so good. Some of Hitchcock's films are like that. Shadow of a Doubt is a darker, more thoughtful. There's a lot of, I mean, there's a very dark side to Hitchcock. And the story of Uncle Charlie, and his very dark view of, that the world is a sty, it's a pigsty, and if you rip away the fronts of the houses, you'll see this horrible, all this awful, and that was pretty strong stuff for the middle of World War II when everybody was being optimistic and, go America and all of that. So it's a very, very interesting. I mean, it's a very interesting film, and it's beautifully done, and it's the suspense is not as powerful in a sense as the other films where the man who knew too much or a lot of these things, where you're sitting at the edge of your seat. It's much more subtle.
It's more something of a mood, of an atmosphere that you create in that film, isn't it?
And also I don't know, there was some film critic said, he said, while World War II raged, Hitchcock and his writers constructed one of cinema's indisputable masterpieces on the nature of evil. That in this little town where everything seems perfect. And it's kind of interesting because I was born in 1945, and I have pictures of me when I was, 8 years old, and I'm wearing a hat. Back in the 50s and the 40s, everybody wore a hat. All the men wore a hat, and you'd wear a tie and you'd wear a jacket, and everything was much more formal. If you got into a taxi cab, the taxi driver had a hat, all these, and it's like your mom is great and your dad is wise and wonderful, and there's all this stuff that nobody believes in anymore. It's sort of gone, it's gone the other way. Your parents are complete idiots, now. But so you have this vision of this sort of perfect little town. I mean, Santa Rosa, California is a perfect little town, where everything is like, I mean, when I was a kid, I mean, we were a Jewish family living in Philadelphia. It's a very large Jewish community there. But I always felt that I wasn't like quite like all American. And that somewhere there was like this town where everything was like perfect American, all the dads were smart and kind, and all the moms knew how to bake a cake and all of that kind of stuff. And that's basically where the film is set. And then you have this the Joseph Cotton character, who's an actor that I love, playing this very dark character who also he's a double himself, because he has this one personality that's very, very dark and depressed. And that opening shot where you see him just lying in the bed, barely moving, he barely moves a muscle. The lady comes in and says, "There's men looking for you," and there's no reaction. And then you cut to the town in Santa Rosa, and he sets it up with the same. There's a big wide shot, and there's a closer shot, and then there's a low angle shot of the window, and then the camera shows Uncle Charlie lying on the bed, rigid. And the camera slowly pushes in, and then you have that whole scene where he's told there are guys looking for him, and he leaves, and then we cut to Santa Rosa. Now the music is very lovely, and the policeman is smiling, and you have the same thing. The interesting thing is that he also has this low angle shot of her bedroom window, but it's the reverse angle. So with Uncle Charlie, the camera is to the right, looking up toward the left. And when you and he's lying with his head on the right side of the screen, looking right to left. And then when we go into Charlie, his niece's bedroom, it's the opposite. So the exterior of the window is on the left looking to the right, and her head is on the left. So if you're shooting a conversation between two people, one is on one side and one is on the other side. This is called screen direction, and if you put the camera in the wrong place, they're both looking in the same direction, which is it just doesn't feel right, if you're having people talking on the phone, you could have them both looking in the same direction. It doesn't quite matter. But if you film the one side of the conversation with the person looking right and the other side of the conversation with the person looking left, that sort of connects them a little bit more. And so he does that in that opening. So he immediately ties these two characters together. And I'm not sure how many people would get that. I mean, it's pretty obvious, but maybe you sort of get it the second time because now you remember. And she actually is, she's feeling also very down, and she's telling her father that the family is that nothing's happening, and she's kind of depressed. But I mean, for him, that's his worldview. For her, that's like an episode out of A Sunny Life. And so to see how that there are elements in her that are in him, because they have this almost telepathic sort of communication that they hears the Merry Widow waltz, and he's known as the Merry Widow killer, and she actually says to him, there's a scene early on where Uncle Charlie is reading the paper, and he sees something in the paper that has to do with this killer, that there's a manhunt all across America looking for this killer, and so he surreptitiously tears the piece out, and then he pretends he's building a little house out of newspaper for the kid. But she immediately sees through it. And so then his suspicion becomes aroused. And just the way he kind of looks at her, and there are these little moments where he kind of builds incrementally, because initially he's the greatest guy in the world, because when he wants to be charming, he can be the most charming person in the world. He's handsome, he's charming, he's full of life, the exact opposite of when you saw him just lying in his room. And you can gradually see her start to shift, and she starts to doubt him, and he starts to doubt her, and eventually he's willing to kill her to save himself. And she starts to see in this perfect little town that there's, and in this perfect uncle, that there's this evil that sits under the surface that she's never experienced, that she's never thought was possible. Hannah Arendt, I don't know whether you've heard of her, a philosopher, and she wrote a lot about what happened with Nazi Germany, World War II, and the Holocaust, and all that. And one of the things that she said that always struck with me was that she said, "Americans don't really believe in evil." I think we do now, but 30 years ago, Americans, I mean, we'd never been invaded. When I was in France, and I traveled all through France, every town that you went into, there was a memorial for the martyrs who were killed by the Nazis. Everywhere you went, so everybody, every you know, everyone in France knows what evil looks like. They've seen it. Everyone in Europe knows what evil looks like. But Americans, and I remember as a kid, I used to think, Well, the Nazis could never be in America. There would never be people who would do that in America. Of course, now, lots of people.
But it's very, sorry,
Go ahead.
it's very interesting, actually, the character of Uncle Charlie, because there is something of a Nazi in him, isn't there? I think he's the one who says that he's willing to kill the people who, according to him, are worthless. And even though World War II is not really discussed in the film, I think that subconsciously it is present through his character, isn't it?
That's a very insightful thought. That I mean that there are people who are less than human and not deserving to live.
And he thinks he can decide. And to add to that, it's interesting that the final scene, the kind of climax of the film, occurs in a train, which is the kind of last scene where we see him alive. But of course, the idea was to kill young Charlotte Charlie. But there too, you could perhaps make a link with the war as well.
Well, I mean, Hitchcock had an affinity with trains.
Sure
Trains
did. I was going to
on
ask you about that, what you
the
think about the role of trains in this film and how it's situated in relationship to other films of his.
Well, and interesting that the films that have doubles, North by Northwest, of course, Strangers on a Train, but yeah, that he took that pretty head on. I mean, part of his was Thornton Wilder, but Thornton Wilder in Our Town presented the view of Santa Rosa without Uncle Charlie. Hitchcock put Uncle Charlie in there.
For our listeners who might not know, Thornton Wilder's Our Town was the exemplary school play in the United States for many, many decades until recently, and was kind of this iconic image of some perfect small town American life.
I think there is also something very unsettling between, I mean, in the relationship between Uncle Charlie and his niece. I would even go as far as saying that it's a bit incestuous, which brings an element, an added element of discomfort into the traditional American family.
Sort of in the middle when he's starting to suspect well there's this so remind me to not get too lost and don't come back to this but so I taught film for a while. I was the only full professor at this university who'd never taken a single course in their subject, which made me very popular with the PhDs and everything, as you can imagine, since they'd spent all this time and I hadn't. But I mean, I have a PhD, the equivalent of a PhD in film. I think I qualify
Of
to
course.
teach it, but my understanding of what a director does really changed as a result of my teaching by just seeing what students did and what they failed to do consistently. And the more and the more that I thought about it, and the more I thought about Hitchcock, it sort of led me to the conclusion that I was talking about the difference between suspense and surprise. But what it really comes down to is that at the very basic level, what the director does or what a writer does is present information. And so how you present it, in what order you present it, what you present and what you don't present, is all about it. I remember the student did a little 5 minute film exercise, and there's a guy and he parks his car in front of a house and he takes out a knife And then he puts the knife away and he goes and he rings the doorbell. So, you know, we know. So I said, but a lot of times what the student will do is the guy takes out a knife, but the student shoots it in such a way that you can't really tell it's a knife. You know, like he knows it's a knife. The person operating the camera, everybody in the room there knows it's a knife, but does the audience know it's a knife? Well, maybe, you know, he didn't show it properly. So it's like how you then give that information. And the man who knew too much, the American version, which by the way, I think is better than the English version. But what's going to happen is they're going to assassinate this ambassador, which is really what's called the MacGuffin. It's the thing that motivates the story, but it really doesn't matter. You know, what it's really about is the boy is kidnapped because the father knows too much and they want to keep him quiet. So that's really what it's about. But anyway, so there's a scene where they're going to assassinate this guy during a concert, and the music is going to build up to a climax. All right, there, you know the movie, right? The movie's going to build up to a climax, and right when they hit the cymbal crash, the assassin is going to shoot him. So no one will know that anything happened because the sound of the orchestra. So and the leader of the plot is dressed up as a clergyman. You know, he's got the collar, you know, and he's meeting with the assassin, and he said, and he says, so here's the music. And he plays the music, da 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 da, bang. And the assassin says, yes, I know. And he says, let me just play it for you again. And he plays it a second time. And just as the cymbal goes, the plotter, he smashes his hands together like he's doing a cymbal. And then the assassin says, okay, got it, you know, and he leaves. And then the clergyman, again, he kind of looks at the phonograph and he puts it on a third time and plays the same thing. Why? Because Hitchcock wants to make sure that you know how this piece of music goes to build the suspense. So he's making positive that he's giving you as much info, you know, he can't give you any more information than that, you know. And so, and in some of Hitchcock's movies, he sometimes moves things around where you learn something earlier. I'm actually trying to remember. There was one that he talks about where, you don't find out something until the, I think it might have been Vertigo, that you learn a little earlier that Madeline and Judy are the same person. Whereas in the book, you don't learn it until later. And he explains why it's, you know, why it's important. But so what's happening during the course of the movie is that Charlie is starting to suspect that there's something wrong with Uncle Charlie. And Uncle Charlie is beginning to suspect that Charlie knows too much because they have this telepathic thing. He actually says to her at one point that they have this and he even says at one point we're like twins. So you can't get more about the doubles than that. And so the suspense is, you know, how is she going to figure, you know, what is she going to find out, and what is he then going to do when he finds out that she knows too much? So there's that scene in the middle where she's learned from this detective who, for I mean, it's the one kind of phony thing. The guy is the detective, and suddenly he's fallen in love with her and wants to marry her after one date. That was a little far-fetched. But the detective sort of implies that her uncle is a murderer, and she starts to think, and then she goes to the library and she sees that the piece he tore out was about this murderer, and now she's very aware, and of course he picks up on it. And so here's so now what's going to happen, where's this going to go, and and she leaves the house and he chases after her, and that's when he kind of gets physical with her, and he takes her into a bar, and the name of the bar, let me see, I
Two,
have it
two.
down here.
Two, two, two.
What?
Two, two, two bar.
Right, the 222 bar, and he orders a double brandy. So you got the two the twos. Yeah. But he physically, he's now grabbing her, and he takes her into this club that's supposedly a little bit not where you take a nice girl. So yeah, there's definitely that starts to happen. It's kind of like a romance that's breaking apart.
But I just wondered if I could come back to the comment about marriage, because I completely agree with you. It's very abrupt that detective, arrives, falls in love with Charlie, and they're already discussing this possibility, 24 hours later. But nonetheless, this relationship to marriage strikes me as really interesting in the film, and I'm wondering what you think about that. The fact that the murder victims are widows, that there's this emphasis on the widow waltz, and then the fact that there's this great speech from the mother where she really openly talks about the fact that she lost somehow her own personal identity and her links with her family when she married her husband and they started their own family. And then you've got young Charlie here on the verge of adulthood, ready to step into a similar role potentially. So I'm just wondering how all those elements mesh together, what you think about that.
Without forgetting the fact that Uncle Charlie gives a ring
Yeah.
to young
Yeah.
Charlie
Yeah.
as
Yeah.
if marrying him.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in there, and the way Hitchcock worked, there's very little that's accidental. I mean, he was so precise that I mean, with a lot of people, when you're really in it and onto it, things sort of pop out that you hadn't expected. I mean, I directed Nightmare on Elm Street 2, which I later found out is, considered one of the great gay horror films, which none of us had the slightest inkling that this was what was going on. And of course, when you start to look at it, there's this subtext, and I was aware of the subtext, but I saw it as a film about teen sexual anxiety, and back in the 80s, if you thought you were gray, that was not a good thing. You could lose your job, you could get arrested, a lot of bad things could happen to you. But there are a lot of things in there that I hadn't specifically said, let's do this, let's do that, but that just sort of happened because, I mean, I cast a gay actor for the part. I had no idea he was gay, but there was something about him that felt, I don't know, maybe he had a certain feminine aspect, and he was playing the final girl, So a lot of these things, but I think Hitchcock was much, much more planned out, that I think very little came out that he didn't put in there. That's not really something that I thought about. I mean, there's a lot that's in there that you can unpack. What I thought was really interesting was at the very end, after Uncle Charlie dies and they're delivering a eulogy, and they're saying he's the most wonderful man, and he was the son of the town, and all of that. while she's outside talking to the detective, saying basically he's this murderer, but we're just going to keep it quiet.
Yeah.
I mean, Hitchcock loved irony. Another interesting thing about the movie, and maybe why it's kind of different from a lot of Hitchcock's other movies, was Hitchcock loved these big set pieces. He loved the scene with the crop duster. There were all these iconic scenes from many of his movies where he just went for some great grand gesture. And if you look at a director like Brian De Palma or even early Spielberg, they also did that. Say they'd have like a big sequence, and I frankly did that too. I would try to have like one big, really great, cool thing. He doesn't really have that in this movie. He doesn't have one of those great big cinematic things. It's all part of the same texture. It doesn't really break out of the texture, to just show off. The cinematic storytelling is much more subtle.
Yeah, the film is very tight. It really functions as a block, and that's goes back to what you were saying about the way it compares to some later movies, like Strangers on a Train or North by Northwest, which are much more about the adventure or about the fact that they're keeping you on the edge of your seat. I mean, that's not really what he's going for, I think, with this.
Right. Some people have said that Shadow of a Doubt was Hitchcock's favorite film. But he and Truffaut actually says, of all the pictures that you've made, Shadow of a Doubt is the I take it that Shadow is of a Doubt is the one that you prefer. And he said, and Hitchcock says, I wouldn't say it's my favorite picture. If I've given that impression, it's probably because I feel that here is something that our friends, the plausibles and logicians, cannot complain about. Because with most with a lot of films, you sort of have there's what's called, well, it's not necessarily the MacGuffin. But there's something that you have to accept and once you like, if you go to see a James Bond movie, 20 people are shooting at James Bond. Nobody hits him. He shoots. Every time he shoots, he kills somebody, right? Or Keanu Reeves is John Wick, and he beats up everybody. Nobody ever beats, That's, you just have to accept, So, if you say this is ridiculous, if James Bond were really, if it were a real person in that situation, he would be shot and killed. If he's facing a guy who's like 200 pounds heavier than him, he'd be beaten up. But you accept it, And with Hitchcock, there was a certain assumption that you just have to make that this was a possibility. And if you really went into it logically, maybe you could see that. And I've certainly found this to be true with my own films, that there's something that you have to sort of buy into. And then once you accept, I did a film with aliens. Well, if you say, well, there aren't any aliens, the film's then you're not gonna the film's not gonna work. But if the film is good and it holds your interest, you don't care. Hitchcock used to talk about the refrigerator syndrome. Do you know about that?
I think I've read about it.
So you go and you see the film, and then you open up. You go home and you turn on the TV, and then during a commercial break, you go to the refrigerator to get a glass of beer or a piece of cheese. And you say, wait a second, how come nobody ever hit James Bond with a bullet whenever, at that point, it doesn't matter, you know,
Mm.
but I guess what he felt was that this story was very tight, you
Yeah.
know, and that everything and the way he unfolds the story of the growing relationship between Charlie and Uncle Charlie, starting with, you know, these two people showing them almost identically, and then having them come and having her sort of coming to realize that there is evil in the world, and eventually she kills her uncle. He wants to kill her, and she kills him. You know, this person who she thought was the most wonderful man in the world. And where does that leave her? You know.
Well,
So.
it's very rich, and I mean it's also of course possible to take it from a psychoanalytical side and to argue that the Uncle Charlie is part of her personality all along, and she needs to integrate somehow this element of evil to accept the fact that she herself, to a certain extent, has bad thoughts.
Yeah, absolutely. Talking about just I was just thinking about when Uncle Charlie arrives in the train. Do you remember the shot
Yes.
where the train is spewing this black smoke? Again, you know, it's not something that every person who watches the film is going to pick up on. But that same train, when it leaves the station at the end of the film, there's no black smoke. But it's kind of like, you know, the devil is coming or something, you know.
Polluting the perfect town.
And he also talks about how he when they were with one of his movies, when they were driving the car, he wanted to have a lot of dust on the road, so there would be a lot of dust in the air. And then with another scene, he had them wet the road down so there wouldn't be any dust. But all of those little, when I was studying to be a classical trumpet player, I studied with the principal trumpet of the Philadelphia Orchestra. You know, he was one of the best. At that point, when you study with somebody like that, you already know how to play the trumpet. So you're learning how to do other things. And I remember that I played something, and he said, "Hold that last note a little longer." So I held it a little longer. He said, "No, don't actually hold it longer. Just make it feel like you're holding it longer." So I kind of tried to do that. He said, "Yeah, that's better." And I remember when I was going home, I thought, "Who's ever going to notice that? Nobody in the world. The difference between the way I did it the first time and the way I did it the second time was like, you know, 0.01%." And I thought, no one will notice that. But if you do that with everything, that level of attention with everything, the whole effect is better. You know, I do a little bit of woodworking. You know, if you want to, you know, you can look at a piece of furniture and it looks really nice. If pull out the drawer and look inside at the part that nobody sees, see what that looks like. And you know, and the good directors do that. There are lots and lots of little things that most people would not notice. Even people who are experienced, you know, have to see the film several times. But all of these little bitty things that just help you to understand what the story is, which is why a guy like Elia Kazan would say, you know, he was one of the great theater directors you know, he was the first person to do Streetcar and a lot of the great American plays of the middle of the 20th century. And he said, when I was working in the theater, my job was to fulfill the desire of the writer. It was all about the writing and my obligation to do that. But as a director, I feel like I'm the one who's telling the story. You know? because you have these other means. And I mean, you could certainly say, well, on the stage, where you move the characters and how you block it and so on is part of telling the story. But where you put the camera, and how there's a million places you can put the camera. You can put it here, you can put it to the right, more to the left, you can put it higher, you can put it lower, you can put it closer, you can put it farther away. All of these things tell the audience something. Like, I mean, we were talking about Hitchcock and how to show somebody thinking. Well, how do you show all right, sabotage. Hitchcock made a movie called Sabotage in England, and he made another movie called Saboteur in America. Saboteur is a really interesting movie. It's a lot of fun, and it has this whole ending that where it takes place on the arm of the Statue of Liberty, which is sort of he did that same thing again, obviously, on Mount Rushmore, but that was his first go. But in Sabotage, there's a great scene that I like to show to my students about whether you need to shoot a master shot, right? A master shot is where you see all of the characters in the same shot. And there's this kind of meek woman who's married to this Germanic guy who it turns out he's a saboteur, and that he planted a bomb that was supposed to go off in a train station, and he gave it to his wife's younger brother. And then, of course, and he tells her he has to get it to the train. He has a package to deliver to the train station, and has to get there by 4 o'clock, which is, of course, when the bomb is supposed to go off. And so you see him in the bus, and things keep slowing the bus down and slowing the bus down. And finally, the bomb explodes on the bus, killing her brother. And actually, Hitchcock felt that the reason that the he thought it was a really good film, but it didn't do very well at the box office, and he felt that was because he killed a teenage boy in the film. But there's a scene where the wife has started to realize that her husband killed her brother, and that he's a saboteur, and she's serving him dinner. I don't know whether you
Yes.
remember the scene. You never see the two of them in the same shot. And she's giving him, and at one point she looks down and she's holding the knife and fork, like a carving knife, to give him his meat. And she just looks down, and you see the knife in her hand with the fork. And you say, she's thinking about the knife. I mean, it's kind of like, Cinema 101, but that's how. And in the scene, you can completely track what she's thinking moment by moment, and that he's. And then at one point, she looks at the knife, and then it cuts to him, and he kind of looks over, and he kind of. And the whole thing is there. I mean, there's dialogue. He's just talking about the cabbages. The woman doesn't make the cabbage. It's irrelevant. Has nothing to do with what's happening in the scene. But the whole thing is. The psychology of it is, I mean, that's why Hitchcock is considered a great director by most, filmmakers. I mean, not to mention film critics, but I mean, he showed us how to do it all.
Yeah. There are so many great details like that in Shadow of a Doubt as well. I'm thinking of a very small but important moment, which is where Charlie, young Charlie, kind of says check to the game of chess with Uncle Charlie when she comes down the stairs. She's holding the banister. And instead of just giving us a close up, which narratively would show that she's wearing the ring, that she has found the ring he's hidden from her, that has the engraving that would provide evidence that he had killed the couple, the woman's initials that are inside. But instead of just giving a close-up to provide that information to the audience, he goes a step further and does a very fast zoom, and then immediately shows the reaction of Uncle Charlie, who's so surprised. And we have to feel that very visceral shock on his part. And we get to live that somehow in our body as a viewer, thanks to this very quick zoom. And it's just little details like that that make this film so powerful, or all of Hitchcock's films, of course.
Hitchcock, I mean, Hitchcock has used that a number of times in Notorious. There's a great scene where there's a party and the camera's way up at the top of the stairs and there are all these people and she's got the key to the wine cellar that holds the that's going to hold the secret. And the camera comes down, and there's all these, in this large setting, there's all these people, but there's one little thing. And it goes down to, and you see the key kind of half hidden in her hand. The best one of all is there's a film called Young and Innocent. Have you ever seen that?
Yes, with
And there's,
the eye of the drummer.
one of the great shots of all time. Where you're in it, the story is basically it's a common Hitchcock story of there's a man who is accused of a crime for which he's not guilty. He manages to convince a woman to believe in him, and together they solve the crime. So they have two clues. One is that they have a matchbook that came, a box of matches that came from a coat that they believe belonged to the killer that has the name of a hotel. And the other thing was that they think that the killer may have had a twitch. And so the woman goes to the hotel in the hopes that maybe she'll find something out. And she walks into the ballroom and there's a huge ball going on. And hundreds of people, and the camera is way, way, and you can see the entire room and hundreds of people. It's a haystack, well, and the camera starts to push in and push in and push in, and then it starts to center on this band, and the band are all in blackface, which is, I showed it at a few years ago, and the students went, "I got cancer." It was unpleasant to see. But anyway, and the band is all in blackface, which was, I guess, something that people did back in the 30s, and it keeps going in and ends up on a close-up, and you see this drummer with a very sad, and it keeps going in and in and in, and it goes to his eye, to one eyeball, and then the eye starts to twitch. I mean, incredibly difficult shot to pull off. And the students that tried to cancel me, I said, well, first of all, it's another time. And second of all, the blackface is another level of obfuscation, to make it even harder to, and there's also a certain irony and a certain, devilish sense of humor to the whole thing, as well. But, irony is something that doesn't play as well as it used to.
Yes, no. But it was, at a time when England was a colonial country. So, I mean, the relationship to other people was not the one it is now. So, this has to be taken into consideration, of course, when you're watching such films. As we are getting close to the end of this episode, I want to ask you the question we ask all our guests usually when we are about to end the episode, and that is there a question you wish we had asked?
No,
Yeah.
I know. I mean, I enjoyed speaking to you because you are people who really, think a lot about this stuff, and there were things that you had gotten from the film that I didn't get, or it was a very good conversation. I learned a few things. So, it's nice to talk to people who share your passion.
It's always a pleasure for us, especially to speak with filmmakers who can really bring that keen filmmaker's eye to discussions of the cinematography. You know, it's not the case with all of our guests, and it's just so fantastic when we have people here who can make those really strong links between the visual and the storytelling.
And also with, sorry, go ahead.
I know, go ahead.
No, I mean, it's also wonderful to be able to chat with people who watch movies that were shot before the year 2000.
Yes. Yeah. I remember when I was doing some reading about Hitchcock, you know, talking about the relationship of, you know, people who actually make films to critique films, and this woman had written an article. She was talking about Hitchcock's use of artifice, and she was talking Hitchcock has a lot of shots where there's rear projection, you know, somebody's in a car, or you know, some. I mean, Hitchcock did not like to go on location. He wanted to shoot everything in the studio. So you know, if there was a shot of somebody standing in the field, you know, he would shoot the close up on the stage, and in the wide shot, he would get a shot of a field, and he would use a rear projection. And she talked about how it always looked phony, you know, and which it does to our eyes now, and that was part of Hitchcock's intention, was to make the artificiality. So that's bullshit. He was into like whatever was the he was the Steven Spielberg or the George Lucas of his time. He was into whatever the height of technology was that he could use. And if he could have gotten it to look better, he would have, you know. So it's kind of ridiculous to say that he wanted it to look phony, you know. So anyway.
Could you tell our listeners a little bit about what we were speaking about earlier before the episode began about the 4K restoration and possibilities to hear you present any of your films coming up?
Yes, well, Nightmare, Warner Brothers is restoring the whole series of Nightmare on Elm Street feature films. And so when they got around to doing number two, which I directed, they asked me if I would come out and supervise or approve what they were doing. I mean, they had transferred from the original negative to 4K. And they also took the original mono track and put it into Dolby Atmos. And it was quite a revelation. A lot of people, I put this out on my Facebook page that I mentioned that I had done this. And a lot of people said, you know, did you take all the grain away? Like Jim Cameron took all the grain away from some of his movies. And I said that they were very specific that they didn't. However, the process of making of putting prints in a movie theater is you shoot the negative, and it's very high quality stock. Depending, I mean, if it's a lot of night stuff, it's a little bit grainier than the daytime. But you then make a what's called a work print, which you edit, and then after the film is all edited and you've locked everything in and there are no more changes, they go and they cut the original negative to match your work print. Then they then make prints, because every single shot, every cut has to be individually color corrected and exposure corrected. Even though you have the greatest cinematographers in the world, you know, I mean, you could be shooting a 2-minute sequence that starts shooting at 8 in the morning and finishes at 6 at night, and the light is just changing a bit, you know, and there's only so much you can do. And then once you get all the color correction done, what's called grading, they then make what's called an interpositive. So they use that negative to make an interpositive. Which is, and sometimes they'll make more than one if it's going to be a wide release. And then they use the interpositive to then make a new negative called an internegative. And they use that internegative to make the prints because they don't want to use the original negative and damage it. But so what you're seeing when you see a print in a theater is it's three generations removed from the original. If you saw a print off of the original negative, it would be one generation removed and there would be less grain, and that's how you want it to look. So each time, and then of course the prints get run through projectors and they get dirt and they get scratches and frames get missing. A lot of times, I get invited to screenings of some of my movies and they say, "And one, we got a 35 millimeter print." And I'll usually take a DVD of the movie and put it in my suitcase. Because sometimes the print is so bad that I say, stop, please play the DVD instead, But this is now going to come out and I also I said, how come you're just doing it in 4K? Why don't you do it in 8K? Because who knows what the and he said, well, we actually did a test, and they look the same because. You can't put any more information in the 8K that you could put in the 4K. I mean, I don't fully understand this, but it looked pretty damn good to me. And then the sound was fantastic. I mean, there's a stupid little sequence where there's a demonic parakeet in the movie, and it's not pretty hard to pull that off. And we did the best that we could. And I always thought it was okay. It was whatever. But with all this. With the music and being able to really hear all the sound effects and the Dolby Atmos, it was like I thought I was watching the birds. It was really good. It's amazing. So I'm very excited about it. And it's if people have nostalgia for the grain, they can go and rent an old shitty thing, or they can get a VHS if they're nostalgic for that. It can really look like shit, But I mean, to me, what it was like was it's like when they take like a painting that was made in 1500 and they restore it, and they take all this varnish that's been put on it off, and they take all of the crap that's accumulated, and they suddenly, wow, look, I we never saw the cat standing behind the, or that blue is so beautiful now. And that's basically what we did was we got the film to look the way the filmmakers really hoped it would look.
Wonderful.
So,
Really
I'm very
exciting.
excited about that.
Yeah. We'll really look forward to.
And I'm trying to talk them into doing it with The Hidden, which is
Oh,
my
that's amazing.
favorite film. And they have people there who really like the film. So hopefully, it didn't make a lot of money the way Elm Street did, but there are people at Warner Brothers who really appreciate the film. And so hopefully one of these days it will get done. But
We do too, and we'd love to see a restored copy. Yeah.
If everything works out well, I'm hoping to come to France in the fall, and hopefully, I have friends now at Warner Brothers, and that they'll give me access to this new version that we can screen in some very good theaters. So that'll be very exciting. I like I said, I love French cinema. It's had a great influence on me, although you wouldn't know it. I mean, I'm a great Bresson fan. I mean, Bresson is the opposite of the films of my films. His films are very slow, but I love his film. I think he's one of the greats. And I love the fact that cinema has always been such an important part of French culture. I mean, you guys invented it, so with the Lumiere brothers. So anyway, it's been great talking with you.
It's
And
go
great talking with you as well.
ahead.
Sorry.
Yes, thank you so much for having taken the time to be with us for this episode of the podcast. It was really, really wonderful to hear you talk about Shadow of a Doubt.
And by the way, today is my birthday.
Oh,
Happy birthday.
I'm actually, believe it or not, I'm 80 years old.
Wow, this is going to be so
Congratulations.
fun.
Thank you for listening to After Images. Please subscribe on your favorite podcast app and follow After Images Podcast on social media.